If you were to fix America, how would you go about it? Find out what one person says today on Principles and Policies. Hello, and welcome to today's Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Chuck Michaelis. As we've been doing for the last few Saturdays, we are running an audio portion of a class taught at Camp American. The teacher you're about to hear is Dr. Michael Kaufman. The explanation at the front of the audio will pretty much explain it to you. This is a very information-rich audio, and you should be aware that there is a video, and there are a lot of teaching aids involved in this, and if this piques your interest, you can buy a copy of the video at www.campamerican.com, and you can also find out how to come and hear Dr. Kaufman this year at Camp American. He is coming to camp. You can come see him at Camp American this year, and again, that's www.campamerican.com. Without further ado, here is Dr. Michael Kaufman with Repairing a Broken America. Dr. Michael Kaufman, he is the CEO of Environmental Perspectives Incorporated. Dr. Kaufman has done extensive work on a number of things. He has done extensive work on biodiversity treaty, which they stopped in the U.S. Senate. Dr. Kaufman has done extensive work on the global warming issue. And that will be melded into what you're going to see today. But Dr. Kaufman's going to kind of give you a broad overview of some of the things that are going on in the United States right now, so you can kind of get some insight of your own from what he is going to teach you. So I want you to give a nice warm welcome to Dr. Michael Kaufman.
Well, thank you, Chuck. I actually got started in what I'm doing right now back in the late 1980s and early 1990s when I was leading a multi-million dollar research effort on global warming nationwide. And during that process, it became very apparent to me that there was no real scientific evidence that man was causing global warming. So I began to trace back what is forcing this agenda. You know, if you need to know what's going on, follow the money trails. That's what I did. And it soon became apparent to me that this was a huge international agenda to create world government, which triggered all kinds of red flags to me because I had done work in prophecy and so forth from my Christian experience, realizing that this was an indication, perhaps, of what the Bible talks about as the end days. The more I dug into it, the more I realized that was exactly what it was, and finally left my job, created my own business, knew it was going to be a starvation business, and trying to help people understand what was actually happening in this country. I'm about to come out with a new book early next month, called Rescuing a Broken America. If you want to find out a little bit more what it's about, I have these little flyers. I'll leave them up here, also back in the storeroom or in the store. You can pick one up and take a look at it. Maybe you or your parents might want to get a copy because from what I hear from the reviewers, it's dynamite. It really does explain what I want to do here today, now, and tonight is to kind of give you a very broad overview, as Chuck said, of what's in this book. Now, obviously, it's going to be very, very incomplete because we can't do a whole book in 2 hours. But hopefully, we'll begin to understand what is happening. The book is broken into three different topics. One is, what's really happening in America? Why are we so deeply divided? How did it happen? Who was responsible? How did they get it done? And then finally, taking America back, what we can do to do that. Fortunately, I don't have a lot of time to talk about that. The last speaker did actually talk about some of the things that I had to eliminate in order to get it done, and that's basically take state rights back. But nonetheless, that's the way we're going to go in the next hour and tonight as well. First of all, I want to help you begin to understand what it is that's causing such a deep division within America today. Now, there has always been political differences. There's always been partisan politics and all the rest. But if you're old enough like I am, and Chuck and Charlie and so forth, you realize that the division today is much deeper, much more violent than anything we've ever seen in the history of this country, except perhaps the Civil War. We're about to rip ourselves apart again, but why are we doing that? What's happening? I'm hopefully going to, and the book does this, to explain exactly why we're so deeply divided, is because we have right now going on a war of worldviews. Now, how many understand what a worldview is? A good majority, but let me explain for those, a few of you who do not. A worldview is your understanding of reality. We have a constitutional understanding of reality. What's happening in this country is anti-constitutional, 180 degrees from the Constitution. Now, there are other worldviews out there, like the radical Islamist worldview that believes that anything that is not Muslim, a radical Muslim, has got to be destroyed in the world. That's what they believe. They believe that with their heart, based on the Quran. Worldviews are extremely important is because it motivates you. It defines who you are and where you're going to go. And right now, we have two opposing worldviews that are literally at war with each other. One understands it fully. The other has no clue. And that's where most of the American people are. The first worldview is the constitutional worldview. I'm going to be using John Locke as the central figurehead. Now, there were others involved in this, other writings and so forth, but I'll use him as the basis of the understanding of this particular worldview. French constitutionalists, Frederick Bastiat, Sir William Blackstone, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, many of our founders had this worldview. In fact, they almost literally quoted John Locke in the Declaration of Independence and certain aspects of our Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights. The other worldview occurred about 80 or 90 years later with Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau was a Frenchman. He was in the process of writing a whole series of philosophies that then led towards the writings of George W.F. Hegel, Karl Marx, led to communism, fascism, and so forth. There are opposing worldviews. Now, you will read in the literature today that they were very much similar. Well, there are some similarities, but their differences are huge. And you won't read that in the literature. They're trying to basically convince you that these two people basically agreed on the same thing. They did not. Absolutely did not. John Locke basically had an understanding that the purpose of government, now that's the whole reason for having government, is to join together to unite for the mutual preservation of their lives, liberties, and estate, which I call by the general name property. In other words, liberty and estate is a form of property in this belief system. The great and chief end, therefore, of man united in the commonwealths or governments and putting themselves under government is the preservation of their property. Now, if you understand that your life, you as a person, is a form of property, you begin to understand the magnitude of what property truly is. Property is not this building, it's not your house, it's not your car, it's far more than that. It's a general understanding of what gives you life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, as Jefferson penned in the Declaration of Independence. Now, this is not lost on the Founding Fathers. James Madison, government is instituted to protect property of every sort, as well as, now notice that every sort, not just your home or your automobile. Well, of course, they didn't have automobiles then. As well as that which lies in the various rights of individuals. It's your rights. It's your human rights. This being the end of government. That alone is a just government which impartially secures to every man whatever is his own, including his own life, and ability to create happiness in his industrious behaviors. Now, Frederick Bastiat, French legislature in the middle 1800s, just came out of the Second French Revolution, that changed their constitution again, wrote this book, little pamphlet, called The Law. Now, he was a student of John Locke, even though he was in France. And I don't think there's any more powerful understanding of what we believe in than this little pamphlet explains. What then is the law? It is a collective organization of the individual right of lawful defense. Each of us has a natural right, I don't know what's going on with the print, from God to defend his person, his liberty, and his property. If every person has the right to defend, even by force, his person, his liberty, and his property, then it follows that a group of men having the right to organize and support a common force, in other words, the government, to protect these rights constantly. In other words, if you have a right to yourself and your property, your life, and so forth, then you have a right to organize in governments in order to protect those rights. Is what he's saying. Since an individual cannot lawfully use a force against the person, liberty, or property of another individual, then the common force, i.e. the government, for the same reason, cannot lawfully be used to destroy the person, liberty, or property of individuals or groups. So you see what he's saying? As individuals, we have these rights. We also have the rights to form a government to protect those rights. But at the same time, we do not have a right to take from someone else or destroy their life. And therefore, since we don't individually have that right, the group or the government does not have that right either. This basically, as Jefferson wrote, the people's law. I also call it the Locke model. What it basically says is that they have God-given inalienable rights, as outlined in the Declaration of Independence. Our rights come not from legislatures, not from man, but from God. The right to have life, liberty, and to be able to pursue what you want to do to be successful. The next power block is the individual itself. He is the sovereign, or she. As individuals, we are sovereigns, given that right by God himself. The government closest to us is the city government or local government. They're the ones that have the greatest power over our civil society. Because we have direct access to them, we can force them to maintain our individual sovereignty. But then there's a need for having county government, state government, and so forth, until finally the least power at all is the federal government. Because that's the most distant from the individual. This is the way the Constitution was established. Thomas Jefferson said it's not by the consolidation or the concentration of powers, but by their distribution that good government is effected. In other words, a division of power. And therefore, we have created a constitutional republic made up of a tripartite federal, where you have legislation, executive, and judicial branches of the government, with some power enumerated, as we just heard, with Article 1, with 18 enumerated powers. Very limited. The state has more power, and the local has even more power yet. But they're all divided. Now, the local government may only have two of those three. It may consolidate the executive and the legislative. But nonetheless, you have power distributed evenly or across a broad spectrum where no one entity has enough power to begin to dominate. That was intentional. They intended to have a very inefficient government. Understand that. When you hear someone talk about making the government more efficient, what you're hearing is to make the government more totalitarian. Why? Because the government cannot be made more efficient unless it's first made more powerful by taking your rights away from you and bestowing them upon itself. It's the only way the government can be made more efficient is to take your sovereignty from you and give it to themselves. That's the only way. And this is the way they had intended the Constitution to work, is distributed power, not allowing any one entity of government to have accumulated enough power to begin to dominate the others. Obviously, that's not what's happened. Now, why is private property rights so important? You never hear much about private property rights, or if you do, it's in a negative context. So what makes private property rights so critically important that our founders understood that's only been recently rediscovered? A Peruvian by the name of Hernando de Soto wrote The Mystery of Capital back around 2001, I think it was, and he revolutionized thinking along these lines. Finally brought us back to an understanding more towards a constitutional republic protecting private property rights than any time probably since the 1800s. Most of you don't know this, but 70% of all small businesses in the United States are started with equity loans on personal homes. Well, you say, well, so what? That's not possible in other countries. We have personal private property rights that are legally established that give value to that property that you can borrow against. And you can start your own business or make investments in the stock market, whatever you want to do. That creates capital. In other countries, in almost all the other countries, especially the developing nations, it takes 10 to 20 years to register property ownership. Why? Because there are no easy ways to do it. Most of the time, you have to go through at least 100 steps, sometimes 200 steps, of different bureaucracies to be able to finally get your private property rights or private property registered. And every one of those steps require a payoff because of corruption. In fact, corruption is the name of the game in these countries. You have to have corruption in order to survive. And as a consequence, by the time an average person who is in poverty gets through all these processes, he spent more money on the process than he had on the private property itself. And so they do never register private property. They're not legally established. You have all this property out there. The local community knows who owns what and so forth, but it has no economic value as far as equity is concerned. You cannot borrow against it. Hence, there is no capital available for you to start a business. And as a consequence, they remain in abject poverty. It's called dead capital. It's there in principle, but it's not there legally. I don't know what's happening to this text. DeSoto estimates there's about $9.3 trillion in the world in this dead capital worldwide. 9.3. Now, we've been tossing around $1 trillion here and $1 trillion there this past year, like it's peanuts, but it's a lot of money. For instance, that is equal to all the capital in the 10 major stock exchanges in the world. In other words, these impoverished nations have the economic ability to get themselves out of poverty based on the capital that they already have but cannot use. It is 93 times more than all the foreign aid ever given and 46 times all the loans ever given by the World Bank. In other words, if these nations had private property rights well established so that they're legally entrenched, we wouldn't have to give them foreign aid. They would have the ability to get themselves out of poverty themselves. But private property rights will never, ever be given to them because the global elite that I'll talk about in a few minutes does not want them to have it. Period. And so it's never part of an evolving constitution as part of a nation that's trying to get itself out of poverty. They do not understand the concept, and the global elite, the banking system of the world, will not suggest that they establish private property rights, even though they know that's the only thing that's going to get them out of poverty. Now, the average income... I'm going to redo this. No, didn't do any good. The average income for the United States or Americans is about $45,000 a year. The socialist European nations, it's about $34,000 a year. Now, the socialist Europeans have a lot more regulation than we do. They have a lot less private property rights than we do, although we're losing them very rapidly. The former communist nations, about $2,000. That's up from 10 or 15 years ago where it was less than $1,000 because of the collapse of the Soviet Union. But they still do not have private property rights that will guarantee legally the wealth that's in form of capital of those rights. Now, if you actually plot an index of legal private property rights protections against the gross domestic product per capita, what you find is a very good correlation, about 74%. It doesn't answer everything, but it's highly related to the ability of that nation to protect private property rights. Now are we beginning to see why John Locke and Madison and the Founding Fathers established a government to protect private property rights? Because they knew that the wealth of the nation and the individuals was solely dependent upon private property rights. Now, there are a lot of other things that go along with it. Well, what causes the variation in the scatter diagram that you see right here? If you look at two nations, the United States and South Africa, what you find is that they have about the same legal index of private property rights, but quite a difference in their gross domestic product per capita wise. Why? Because basically back in 1992, until that point of time, they had apartheid. You know what apartheid is? It's class segregation. It basically means that the blacks had no political power, no right to own property, and so forth. That right was given to them in 1992, except they had no idea what to use it for. Gradually, they're beginning to improve that situation, but because of the segregation that occurred for centuries in South Africa, their gross domestic product is much lower than it should be given that level of private property rights. But it's changing and it's improving. So it can be done. In fact, in Peru, one county, equivalent to a county in Peru, was given this right. They registered their private property rights without all the social dogma that goes along with it and corruption. And instantaneously, they created $6 billion worth of assets that they could then invest in whatever they wanted to do. It didn't last very long. It lasted less than 5 years because the next government didn't like that idea. They wanted a socialist government, so they abandoned the idea. But it worked. And it's critically important that we begin to understand how important private property rights are. Now, there are other aspects of the Bill of Rights are also important, as we just heard with Amendment 2. But without private property rights, nothing else matters. Now let's take a look at the Jean-Jacques Rousseau model of government. He basically said that whoever refuses to obey this very amorphous, existential general will should be constrained to do so by the entire body, in other words, the government. Now, he has established this concept of the general will. Who defines what the general will is? The government. Not the individuals, but the government. And whoever refuses to obey this is constrained by the entire body. Who's the entire body? The government. In this lies a key to the working of the political machine. This alone legitimizes civil undertakings. In other words, the government is basically in control. The government is the sovereign. Now, what does he think about property rights? He goes on to say that property rights were designed by the rich to place new fetters on the poor and give new powers to the rich. Remember, he still lived with the old feudal system. Do you understand? How many understand what the feudal system was? Okay, not as many. The feudal system dominated the Middle Ages. It's when the king had all the power and gave some of it to the royalty, and then everybody else, the other 95% of the population, were serfs. That was feudalism. Now, as we heard with Larry Pratt, that ended in England with the Magna Carta. And over a period of several hundred years, until the writings of John Locke, gradually more and more power was given to the common person. First the royalty, and then the common person. And so when John Locke wrote his information, he was not that much intimately familiar with the feudal system. But in France, it still existed. And so when Rousseau was writing his, he looked around and he saw this abuse by the royalty and basically came up with the fact that it was designed by them to take more away from the poor and give more powers to the rich, which irretrievably destroyed natural liberty and, for the advantage of a few ambitious individuals, subjected all mankind to perpetual labor, slavery, and wretchedness. You see, he has a 180-degree difference of opinion about private property rights. To him, private property rights were evil. They suppressed the people. Now, what's the difference? The difference is, in the Locke model, everyone has those rights. The Jean-Jacques Rousseau model, what he was seeing, only the select few had those rights. He goes on to say that the state... it's hard to read this. The state, in relation to its members, is master of all goods through the social contract, which, within the state, is the basis of all rights. So now what we have is the state is the sovereign over the individuals. With John Locke and the Constitution, the individual is sovereign over the state or the government. 180-degree difference, and yet you read about this in your popular history books and so forth. The two men were talking about the same thing. They were not talking about the same thing at all. In fact, when Jefferson went over and Patrick Henry went over to France because they thought the revolution was going to be patterned after the American Revolution, what they found was they were horrified. In fact, Patrick Henry would have probably been condemned to die because he spoke out so much, and he was only rescued by Jefferson to send back to the United States. He says he's speaking out against what the French had done in their revolution. Their revolution was bloody, very bloody. Now, going back to Frederick Bastiat, what he says is the socialists, because they had instituted a socialist government, desire to set themselves above mankind in order to arrange, organize, and regulate it according to their fancy. Like Rousseau, they desire to force mankind to docilely bear this yoke of the public welfare that they have dreamed up in their own imaginations. In other words, it's a contrived form of government, socialist based on socialism. Then he goes on to say, the law has been used to destroy its own objective. It has been applied to annihilating the justice that it was supposed to maintain. The law has placed the collective force of government at the disposal of the unscrupulous who wish without risk to exploit the person, the liberty, and the property of others. In other words, what Frederick Bastiat was saying was that the whole purpose of government has been turned on its heads 180 degrees, and now the unscrupulous can milk it for all it's worth through corruption. Redistribution of income. The law has converted plunder into a right in order to protect that plunder, and it has converted the lawful defense of life, liberty, and property into a crime in order to punish lawful defense. So what was your right to defend your property, your life, your way of doing things, is now made illegal. And if you try to protect yourself, you go to jail. If you try to protect what is yours, you go to jail. As long as it's admitted that the law may be diverted from its true purpose, that it may... Oh, man, this is really bad. You know what? We're on slide number 20. Hopefully this will do it. Okay, there we go. As long as it's admitted that the law may be diverted from its true purpose, that it may violate property instead of protecting it, then everyone will want to participate in making the law. Because now the state legislature is there to hand out goodies to their favorite class. Instead of protecting everyone equally, the law now allows people to be selected out to give benefits or to punish. Either protect themselves against the law or plunder it to use for plunder. Going on, political questions will always be presidential, prejudicial, dominant, and all-absorbing. There will be fighting at the door of the legislative place, and the struggle within will be no less furious. Why? Because people are struggling and they're trying to grab what they can to protect themselves or to take from somebody else what they want. Is there any need to offer proof that this odious perversion of the law is a personal or perpetual source of hatred and discord, and that it tends to destroy the society of itself? This is exactly what is causing the division in America today, is because this is where we are. We have a class, an organization of Rousseau people who want to take things from everyone else and give it to their favorite charity or themselves. And you have the other class who's trying to protect themselves. And you're having deep, deep divisions. Thomas Jefferson later said that when all government recognized this after coming back from France, when all government, domestic and foreign, and as little as great things, shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless the checks provided of one government on another that we've learned about this week, and will become as venal and as oppressive as the government from which we have separated. Is that happening today? You better believe it is. And we were warned. What we're seeing here is Thomas Jefferson's the feudal ruler model of government, where the central government is the all-powerful government, which has power over the state government, which has power over the local government, which now has power over you. You are no longer the sovereign. The federal government is the sovereign over everything else. And that is why we're fighting this last fight. If we don't start reversing this tendency this year, in this upcoming election, I don't think we'll ever get it back. It's that close. Now, what has it produced? A two-class system. The top 1% of American taxpayers pays 40% of all taxes. You never hear about that. The top 1%. The top 2 to 5% pay another 20%, or a total of 60%. The top 5% of all taxpayers pays 60% of all taxes. The top 6 to 25% pays another 26%, so now you're up to 86%. And the top 26 to 50% pays 10%, or almost 11%. And so you're up to 97% of all taxes paid are paid by the top 50% of all taxpayers. And the bottom 50% only pays a little less than 3%. Well, that's the way it should be, right? No. This is a Rousseau model. What it says, basically, is that the legislature, the congressman, or whatever, can convince the lower 50% that the upper 50% is ripping them off and should be punished by higher taxes. Now, how many times have we heard that in the last 6 or 8 months? It's constant. It is the perfect recipe for class warfare. The top 50% pay almost all the taxes. Most of that's even paid by the top 25%, even the top 5%. And the bottom 50% want more benefits at the expense of the top 50%. And so we're having legislation exactly to do that. Because that's where the voting bloc is. It's extremely destructive. Not only that, but what we're seeing here is a huge distortion in our economic system because of it. If you look at the base compensation of the private sector, it's $50,000 a year. That includes everything. If you include public, it's $79,000 a year. In other words, the private sector is paying for the public sector. The private sector doesn't earn nearly as much as the public sector. And folks, that's not sustainable. In fact, there are now more, as of with this recession, there are more public jobs than there are private jobs in this country. You cannot sustain that, but it actually gets worse. When you throw in fringe benefits, the average American gets $59,000 a year in base salary plus fringe benefits, and the public sector gets $120,000 a year. Now, you're going to college. Where do you think you want to go get a job? In the private sector or the public sector? And where does our productivity come from? Does it come from the private sector or the public sector? Private. This is a no-win situation. It's destructive. And this is what these liberals, I call them progressives, other people call them socialists or even communists. The fact is that it cannot work. It's self-destructive. Our U.S. debt, national debt, $13 trillion. 10 years ago, it was $5 trillion. It'll be $14 trillion by the end of the year. The federal budget is $3.5 trillion. And we're going into deficit spending at a rate of $1.4 trillion this year. We can't sustain that. We can't continue to borrow more money to try to restart the economy. because there is no way that it can be done. You cannot borrow yourself out of debt unless you're developing a product that is going to return it, and right now we have no product to be able to sell. We basically imported all our jobs overseas. It is terribly destructive, and we have to stop it, and we have to stop it right now. Now, how do we get to this position? One of the principal ways is a way that most people have no clue about until recently. We've all heard about ACORN and SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, and the role they're playing. I want to show you something that is not well known.
Well, new developments in the hot debate breaking this week on the limits of public protest. Here are some photos from a public union demonstration. As many as 500 SEIU demonstrators swarming the home of a Bank of America executive. This guy's associate general counsel. He's basically a lawyer for Bank of America in a suburb of Washington, D.C.
What's wrong with this picture right off the top? They're on his property. Do they have any right to be on his property? No. You know what the police did? Nothing. They basically extorted them there. Forgive me. My mind is not wrapping myself around some of the pronunciation of the words. But nonetheless, they brought them there, and then they protected them. Why? Because their reason was they were afraid of what might happen if they tried to arrest anyone. What happened to protecting the citizens? In other words, they have the force of law behind them now, not the private individual.
According to organizers, the protest was aimed at highlighting the role banks played in the financial meltdown. Some scared and shocked neighbors, including Nina Easton, complaining about what they saw, saying it crossed the line to target a private citizen's home. Hundreds, look at the picture, hundreds, 14 buses of people showed up and stormed this house. Inside is, I believe, a 14-year-old boy by himself calling to the neighbors saying, I'm scared, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
In no world is that acceptable. I protest the lawmakers who passed those laws. Why protest people who pushed it? One side has an agenda, these folks have an agenda. Since when is it okay to target the home of your adversary? Go protest the halls of Congress, like we've done for decades. What about the choices that those homeowners made? All right, because they want...
Okay, the other woman that you saw there was a progressive liberal of the Roosevelt Foundation. And she'll go on and try to say, well, the Tea Party people are doing the same thing. They're not doing the same thing. She raised a red herring that had no truth to it. I'm not going to play that part of it. But the question is, why were they even allowed to do this? And how long have they been doing it? We didn't know this because the mainstream media never told us. But this kind of activism has been going on for decades. And one of the ways that they got these toxic loans, mortgages, pushed through the Bank of America and so forth, was because of this activity in the front of the CEO's house and the board of directors. Now, what do you think this 14-year-old teenager was thinking inside when you had 500 people surrounding the house? They're going to kill me. You're not seeing it there because it's not action, but they were noisy, they were shouting at the top of their lungs, they were doing all kinds of violent seeming activities. And if the wife was home, what do you think she's going to tell her husband when he got home? One or two times like this, and the CEO and the board of directors are willing to capitulate to keep this from happening. And that's exactly what happened in the 70s, 80s, and 90s to create this backlog of toxic loans. Oops.
Union workers who are accused of beating up an African-American man outside a political event are now facing criminal charges. But the reason for the alleged attack and how all sides have responded are what makes it interesting. Here's correspondent Shannon Breen.
Gladney was at a St. Louis healthcare town hall to make some extra money, selling Don't Tread on Me flags to Tea Party supporters when he says he was suddenly attacked, hit, and kicked by two men police identified as members of the Service Employees International Union. While his physical injuries have healed, Gladney says his life has been topsy-turvy ever since the incident.
myself, my family, we're afraid, actually. You know, we don't know if they can get away with this, you know, what else will they be able to get away with?
For months, Gladney and his supporters have waited for prosecutors to take action, and just before Thanksgiving, they did. County Councilor Patricia Reddington issued county ordinance violations, not the felony criminal charges Gladney was expecting. He says the prosecutors never even contacted him. Gladney's also waiting to hear from SEIU, hoping the union will publicly apologize. Despite numerous requests from Fox, the SEIU declined to comment on the case, instead referring us to a statement it issued the day after the incident. It makes no mention of Gladney or the attack, instead focusing the attention on what it called, quote, the teabaggers' violent tactics. It goes on to state, quote, let's be clear, these groups, backed by insurance companies and corporate front groups, want nothing more than to preserve the status quo system. But SEIU and hardworking women and men all over this country are standing up to their bullying tactics. Gladney says he won't be bullied either, and neither will his supporters, who are vowing to go over Patricia Reddington's head to the county prosecutor, hoping to pressure him to reconsider the case and file felony charges.
I think we need to stand up as Americans and fight, you know, the injustice that's going on around us, you know. Like I said, it could happen to anyone.
Gladney also says that one of his attackers used the N-word, and he wants to know why hate crimes charges aren't pending now. He shouldn't expect any answers from the county councilor, Patricia Reddington, who filed the charges. She says she will not comment on the case now that it's in the court system. Brett.
Shannon, thank you.
Who was doing the violence? SEIU. You'll find that time after 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 ad nauseum. Or ACORN. Or a similar group. Who are they accusing of being violent? The Tea Parties or the average citizen? What is the news media reporting besides Fox News? It's the Tea Parties that are violent, not the SEIU. Who are the police protecting? SEIU. Who are the courts protecting? SEIU. Are you beginning to see a pattern here? We are literally at war with an alien concept. It would be like Russia was advancing on us, and we were just sitting back, oh, gee, I wonder what's happening. But the average American is having their perception formed by the mainstream media, which is taking an advocacy position to implement this Rousseau statism where the government is sovereign over the individual. And we have to stop it. The 2008 financial collapse, the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977, ACORN and others like it, acted as shock troops, just as you saw right there, time after time, year after year, with impunity, to get these banks to offer these toxic loans that the banks knew were bad loans. The Financial Services and Modernization Act of 1999 repealed what is known as the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. The Glass-Steagall Act prevented these huge, monolithic, too-big-to-fail organizations to be created. And now we have too-big-to-fail organizations or institutions that we have to bail out with our own tax money for their bad decisions. The Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000 allowed credit derivatives or the credit default swaps to be created, which means that if you take one of these toxic mortgages, you can sell or buy insurance to protect you in case it goes bad. And usually the insurance is worth more than the toxic asset in itself, which makes them favorable. They didn't want it to fail. And so when they finally started to fail, they called the insurance company, the AIG insurance company, to make good on their backing, except the AIG had nothing to give them. It had no capital resources whatsoever to pay back these credit default swaps. Why? Because the government did not protect the average citizen from this by forcing them to have a certain percentage of capital assets to back up their guarantees. Now, what has happened since then? Well, I'm sorry. Freddie Mae and Freddie Mac could not absorb these toxic mortgages, and they are being bailed out by the tunes of hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, James Madison said this, in all cases where a majority are united by a common interest or passion, the rights of the minority are in danger. A pure democracy can admit of no cure for the mischiefs of the majority and that there is nothing to check the inducements to sacrifice a weaker party. We have been convinced as a nation where democracy, any concept of a constitutional republic is gone, and a democracy are two wolves and a lamb deciding on what to have for dinner. He goes on to say, hence it is that such democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal securities, or the right of property, and have been general in their short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. This is our future. If we continue to go down this road, we will consume ourselves and rip apart the very fabric that made this nation great. If we go back to the Locke model, what has happened to the Rousseau special interest groups and big money and global elite, I'll be talking about that next, the special interest groups you have, we are creating almost completely now the Rousseau feudal model. Very close. I'm convinced if this cap and trade law or legislation is passed that Obama announced two nights ago, it'll be over. We'll never get it back. The next thing, and I've got about, 10 minutes? Let me go over because I got started late. All right. How did it happen? The global elite, who are they? Well, most of you understand this. I'm not going to spend much time on it. But if you read Tragedy and Hope, Carol Quigley's book, 1,310 pages long, published in 1966, he basically says that the powers of the financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less to create a world system of financial control in the private hands able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This is what he said was going to happen. This is the objective of this financial elite or global elite. The system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion. Few people at the top, everybody else is a serf. By the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements, the apex of the system was to be the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. What is our central bank? The Federal Reserve. It's nothing to do with federal government. We don't have any control over it. It's privately held. Remember that as we go through this discussion now. Back in 2002, the United Nations International Conference on Finance for Development, the Bank of International Settlements, the BIS, was authorized to establish the process to grant the United Nations access of all financial records of all nations, to strengthen the financial regulation and supervision of all international monetary exchanges, develop financial standards and their implementation. Are you seeing a pattern here? Establish exchange rates and capital accounting regimes. What does this mean? Eventually, it's going to create a global monetary system, and it could happen as early as next year. Make International Monetary Fund, the IMF, more flexible. What does that mean? To become the world's central bank. Who has control over the IMF? The U.S. Federal Reserve. Who has control over the Bank of International Settlements? The U.S. Federal Reserve and the Bank of England. They control almost half of all international monetary exchanges. What Carol Quigley said back in 1966 is happening right now, today. What about the Financial Reform Act that's going on in the Senate right now? Well, the Congress, because the Senate's already passed. They're working together with the House. It's based on the premise that free markets are the cause of the 2008 collapse and capitalism has failed. How many times have you heard this on the evening news? It does not reinstate a Glass-Steagall-like breakup of financial institutions that are too big to fail. Keeping these intact, in fact, not only are these too big to fail institutions still protected, they have created a bailout fund for them at your expense. Now, they will say they'll have $50 billion that the institutions themselves will have to put into it, but the only ones they protect are the biggies. These are the ones that are in control of this whole global agenda. The average bank, they have to pay for it, but they are not getting any benefits from it. No reform of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Of all the institutions that needed reform, it's these two institutions, and they are clear and free. And finally, it greatly expands the oversight role of the U.S. Federal Reserve. It gives U.S. Federal Reserve's tremendous, tremendous oversight powers of our economy. A private institution having no accountability to the United States citizen whatsoever. And now is going to be in charge of our economy if it's actually signed by the president. Got a couple more minutes. Okay. Let's go into the environmental fraud. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature, you've never heard of this, or if you have, you probably heard it from me. The IUCN is the originator of the concept of sustainable development. Now, Tom DeWeese earlier in the week talked about this. Ecosystem management based in eco-spiritualism. Well, what in the world is eco-spiritualism? Well, you're going to find out. I'm not going to go into it in much detail. But the purpose of the IUCN that was on their website a number of years ago was to promote alternative models for sustainable communities and lifestyle based in eco-spiritual practices and principles to accelerate our transition to a just and sustainable future. Humanity must undergo a radical change in its attitudes, values, and behavior. And boy, we're undergoing that right now. In response to this situation, a new global ethics is taking form and is finding its expression in international law. Global warming treaties, biodiversity treaties, any number of treaties. Sustainable, by definition, means not only indefinitely prolonged, but by nourishing, as the earth is nourishing to life and the self-actualization of people and communities. The word development need not be restricted to economic activity, but can mean the evolution, the unfolding, and the growth of and fulfillment of any and all aspects of life. This is what sustainable means. This is what they're driving us to. It's a new belief system. It's called pantheism. Well, it's actually not new. It's been around since humanity's been here. It's the belief that nature is God and we must bow down to nature and meet its needs, not our needs. Understand this. Nature, their perceived needs of nature will overcome any perceived need or any actual mean need of mankind. Period. That means we have to lower our standard of living by at least half. And that's what the legislation on cap and trade is designed to do. I'll talk more about that tonight. We have three primary non-government organizations. You know, Charlie was talking about non-government organizations last night. We need to defund those. The IUCN is one of them. And the IUCN is made up of the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Park Service, the U.S. Forest Service, and about a half a dozen other U.S. agencies, along with the Sierra Club, Nature Conservancy, National Wildlife Federation, National Audubon, National Resources Defense Council, the Environmental Defense Fund, you name it, they're in it, along with the United Nations Environmental Program, the United Nations Development Program, UNESCO, and so forth. They can get behind closed doors and develop an eco-spiritual strategy based in pantheism. Media are not allowed. We have sent people there as plants. They report back to us that if you go to one of these IUCN meetings, it's like not walking into another planet. It's like walking into another universe. These people are so far out and so extreme that you can't even fully understand what they're talking about. But what they have done is through federal agencies adopting these techniques without congressional authority and environmental groups putting on pressure from the other side, they're implementing and have implemented their eco-spiritual strategy locally. I want to talk in the last couple minutes here about private property rights, and then we'll have to quit for lunch. The IUCN, based on the Russo model. This was in United Nations Habitat 1 in Vancouver, May 31st June 11th in 1976. The provision of decent dwellings and healthy conditions for people can only be achieved if land is used in the interest of society as a whole. Public control of land use is therefore indispensable. Understand this. This has been the United Nations backbone now for over 30 years. They believe that governments must control all land use in every nation. That's part and whole cloth part of Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is a 40-chapter document that defines what you can do in every aspect of your life. 40 chapters. It's a statement of principle. Now, Agenda 21 was implemented in the United States in 1992-93 through the President's Council on Sustainable Development. Tom DeWeese may have talked about this, in a document called Sustainable America, a New Consensus. And in that process, future progress requires that the United States broaden its commitment to environmental protection to embrace the essential components of sustainable development, environmental health, economic prosperity, social, and all this other is just trite. The key thing here is environmental protection. We're becoming a society whose focus primarily is on protecting the environment as our reason for existence. It goes on to say this means reforming the current system of environmental management and building a new and efficient framework, making the environment the central organizing principle of our society, just as Al Gore said back in the 1990s. This is what this document commands us to do. And worse than that, what we're seeing is that all of our federal agencies have a new direction as of 1995, and all these other departments, to make the environment the primary reason for their existence. They're protecting the environment against you and I. That's the reason for their existence. Their existence is not there to help you and I, as they're originally created. It's to protect nature from you and I. So what we're seeing here is sustainable development, President's Council on Sustainable Development. There's a second document that came out in 1999, Sustainable America. And they hit climate change, environmental management, and sustainable communities. And we're going to, after tonight, take a look at climate change and sustainable communities, because it'll shock you. It will really shock you what they're doing. Do I have time for a quick question? Yes. Hang on. I'm cutting into your fun time now.
If we've got time, I've actually got two. When you were talking about the Federal Reserve, you know, being the head of all this, there's been a tremendous push and all kinds of signatures for this Audit the Fed bill. Do you have any knowledge as to the progress or where that is?
Well, it's never going to pass. What we can hope is that the number of co-sponsors keeps increasing to the point where it starts to draw public opinion as to why are we wanting to audit the Fed. Most people don't even understand that the Fed is a private organization. They believe it's part of the federal government. It's not. If we can get to the point where they begin to understand this is a private organization, and this Financial Reform Act of 2010 basically gives all financial control of our economy over to a private organization, I think that's going to really trigger some backlash, and I hope it can come out before the elections. Because like the health care plan, this Financial Reform Act needs to be revoked. It's going to go through. It's already passed both houses. They're just merging the two now. And obviously Obama will sign it. And as soon as we can control back of the House and the Senate, hopefully we can actually overcome or defund it and never let it happen, because people are beginning to understand and having a backlash. It's never going to pass, not in this Congress. It may pass in the next Congress.
Okay, and as a follow-on then to this sustainable development and all of these federal agencies that are, you know, making their primary focus the environment, can the state sovereignty issues come into this where they can stop the funding?
I'm glad you're saying that. I really do think that what the states can do, and I really support what Larry Pratt was saying earlier, is that we need to support the state rights movement and begin to have the states balk at implementing all of this stuff and actually prevent it from happening in their states. Because if we can do that, the people themselves begin to start to have the opportunity of taking it back. Now, I'm going to be offering you another potential solution that's built into almost every state and federal law that nobody knows about, that you can use at the local level to protect your local people from county, from state, from federal intrusion and abuse. And it's worked. It's stopped multi-billion-dollar projects and so forth. It works very well if you do it right. And I'll talk to you more about that tonight. But again, it's local control. Everything goes back to local control.
To find out more about Dr. Michael Kaufman or this presentation or how to come see Dr. Michael Kaufman at Camp American this year, June 24th through 30th, contact us at www.campamerican.com. Join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.